Hello everyone, I'm Amanda Balby, Managing Editor at Consultant360.com. Food allergies are a growing health concern around the world and can severely impact quality of life and overall health for affected individuals and other stakeholders. In light of this growing concern, the National Academies of Sciences, Engineering, and Medicine have constructed recommendations regarding the prevalence, diagnosis, prevention, and management of food allergies. Here today to speak with us about these recommendations is Dr. Sharon Donovan, Professor of Nutrition and Director of the Illinois Transdisciplinary Obesity Prevention Program at the University of Illinois. She is also a past president of the American Society for Nutrition. Thank you for speaking with us today, Dr. Donovan.
Thanks for having me on.
So many foods can cause allergic reactions, but what are the most prevalent food allergies?
So in the U.S., the foods that we refer to as the Big Eight food allergens are peanuts, tree nuts, cow milk, egg, wheat, soy, fish, and shellfish. It's important to note, however, that food allergens that are most prevalent depend on the country that you live in. So for example, when you look at Asia, sesame allergies are more common, whereas in some countries in Europe, mustard is a more common allergen. However, currently in the U.S., the Big Eight that I mentioned are considered the primary allergens, and that leads to food labeling and other recommendations.
And how can healthcare providers or people in general better understand the prevalence of food allergies in the U.S.?
Keeping in mind that, you know, food allergies are immune reactions, and these are mediated by antibodies. So in order to have a true food allergy, we need to have IgG, immunoglobulin G, directed specifically against those food proteins. So these are different than food intolerances, such as the lactose intolerance, which is a lactase deficiency, or other adverse food reactions people may have, for example, to things like monosodium glutamate or caffeine or other types of foods. So one of the reasons we don't have good evidence on the prevalence of food allergies is because in many cases, patient self-report may be used. And these have been shown in studies to consistently overestimate allergy prevalence. So what we need to have a true, accurate prevalence levels are appropriate tests. So currently our estimates of the prevalence of what we call IgE-mediated food allergies in the U.S. can range from 2 to 10%, affecting 12 to 15 million individuals. It's one of the things that we've also seen over time is that about 39% of food allergic children actually have severe reactions, so anaphylaxis, which would require epinephrine and other medical support. And about 30% of food allergic children have multiple food allergies. So, you know, over time we've seen an increase in the prevalence of food allergies, but in talking with the allergists on the National Academies Committee, what they've noticed is not only are we seeing an increase in allergy, but the severity of the reactions have been greater. And they're seeing many more children who have multiple food allergies.
You kind of alluded to this before, but what are some appropriate diagnostic tests for food allergies?
Right. So, you know, as I mentioned, the accuracy of estimating the prevalence of food allergy is dependent on the quality of the tests used. So patient self-report is not accurate in determining allergy. There's other tests that can be commonly given, one where we're taking a blood sample and measuring the level of IgE in the blood, and this can be referred to as ImmunoCAP or RAST testing, R-A-S-T. The other is a skin prick test where small amounts of food allergens or other allergens, it could be, you know, environmental allergens such as seasonal allergies. These are injected under the skin, and then after a certain amount of time, you measure the wheal or the raised area. So these tests are better than patient self-report because they're actually measuring the level of IgE. However, they are just measuring sensitization. They're about 95% accurate in predicting and that the person is not allergic. So if there's no reaction to either, there's no IgG in the blood or no skin test, we know that patient's not allergic. However, even if we see a positive response, they're still only about 50% accurate in diagnosing whether that person will have an actual allergic reaction upon the ingestion of food. So simply sensitization to a food, having the IgE, does not say that they will have a food allergic reaction. So the gold standard test for food allergies is what we call a double-blind placebo-controlled food challenge. And this, it's double-blind, meaning again that neither the patient nor the doctor administering the allergen knows if they're receiving the placebo or the allergen. Again, placebo controlling so that, you know, the doctor can determine whether the reaction is to the actual food that's being introduced versus a placebo. These are typically given in small amounts, and they're masked in some sort of a other food, such as, you know, an applesauce or something. And so again, the patient is unaware if they're actually getting the allergen. So these should be done in a doctor's office, administered by a physician, and ideally an allergist who's trained in administering and interpreting these double-blind placebo-controlled food challenges. So when the NAS report was written, we were really trying to focus on studies where food allergies had been diagnosed using the double-blind placebo-controlled food challenge. However, in reading the literature, you know, there's many studies that are published where they're reporting either the RAST or the skin prick test or even patient report. And so that's one of the reasons why we have such a broad estimate of the prevalence of food allergies. But one of the recommendations from the report is that in the future, as we move forward, that we do use this gold standard test for diagnosing a food allergy.
The recommendations also mention that diagnostic tests shouldn't be used in solidarity to make a food allergy diagnosis. What other factors should be considered?
Basically, yeah, this concept that just because you have a positive IgE doesn't mean that you will have food allergic reactions, you know, upon eating that food in a realistic amount. And so that's why you should consider something where that patient is actually screened with an oral ingestion of that food.
What role does the patient history play in diagnosis?
Again, that's a really good question. And we know that genetics plays a role, that, you know, food allergies run in families and that, you know, if there's a family history, that the child is at higher risk. However, understanding the role that genetics plays is something that we're still studying. There's been some genome-wide association studies that have tried to look at associations between different genes and the risk of food allergies. One area that's gotten a lot of attention is a gene called filaggrin, which is encodes a protein and keratin filaments in our skin. So it's very important for keeping that barrier function in your skin. And so some of the they're finding that people with defects in this gene have a higher risk of peanut allergy in particular. So some of the current thinking is that initial exposure to food proteins through aerosol exposure, either through the skin or the respiratory tract, is a factor in the development of food allergy. So that whereas when foods are eaten and delivered through the gastrointestinal tract, we don't see that sensitization. So studies have shown that individuals with filaggrin defects or filaggrin variants have an increased risk of eczema and peanut allergy that are about sevenfold higher than individuals without filaggrin defects, and they have a later propensity to develop asthma. So, you know, we're still, I would say, kind of in our infancy in terms of understanding genetics, but we know that genetics plays a role. But allergies are really a gene environment interaction, so that there's higher risk individuals, But there's factors in the environment that can potentially mediate whether that individual actually develops an allergy or not.
How can food allergies be prevented?
Again, that was something that was a big focus of the report. And so we reviewed all of the recent literature and, tried to come to some conclusions. One of the issues that kind of comes up, and I'll talk about this a little more with the LEAP study, is it's very difficult to do randomized controlled trials for allergies or prevention of allergies. So, for example, it's been thought that breastfeeding may reduce atopic dermatitis or allergy, but we can't go into a hospital and randomize mothers to breastfeed or formula feed or feed a regular formula or hydrolyzed formula. So much of our observations about, for example, whether breastfeeding can reduce the risk of developing allergies comes from observations. And this can run into what we call reverse causality, because it may be that mothers who they themselves have a history of food allergies may be more likely to breastfed their infants, thinking that this may prevent their children from developing food allergies. So that we sort of see this paradoxical observation that breastfeeding may not be as protective as we really thought. There's some evidence that exclusive breastfeeding for 4 months may have some potential benefit for reducing cow muck allergy in the first 2 years of life. There's also this introduction of potential allergens in the first 4 to 6 months of life, and I'll talk about that as well. So, we know a little bit about prevention, and much of what we've learned has come rather recently with some work coming out of the UK. So back in 2000, the American Academy of Pediatrics recommended avoidance of potential allergens in infants that were at high risk for developing allergy and as identified by a strong family history. So for example, they recommend delaying the introduction of solid foods until at least 6 months, until a year for dairy, 2 years for eggs, and 3 years for peanuts. And so this was in 2000. But by 2008, they observed that the incidence of allergies, and particularly peanut allergies, continued to increase. They didn't have any good evidence, but in 2008 they recommended, not to delay solid foods beyond 4 to 6 months of age, but they really offered no guidance regarding the optimal timing of introduction. So that kind of led us into a really nice series of studies that have come out of the laboratory of Dr. Gideon Lack, who is a member of our National Academies Committee, and he's at King's College London. And he published a paper in 2008 where they looked at children in being treated in allergy clinics and found that peanut allergies were much higher in populations such as the UK and the US, where peanuts were avoided in infancy, compared to countries where peanuts were introduced in infants. So, for example, in Israel and the Philippines. So this led him to question, is actually the recommendation to avoid food allergens until the children get older maybe the opposite of what we should be doing? So he and his colleagues conducted a randomized controlled clinical trial, which again is very difficult to do in nutrition studies in general, but also in allergies. And so the goal was to determine the best strategy to prevent food allergies in young children. And this is called the Learning Early About Peanut Allergy, or LEAP study, and has received a lot of attention over the last couple years. So they took 640 children, or infants between 4 and 11 months of age, who were identified at high risk for peanut allergy based on either an existing egg allergy or the presence of severe eczema. So they enrolled the children and they randomized them to two groups. One followed the normal recommendation, so the control group, so they did not ingest peanut-containing food. And their consumption group were recommended to consume a peanut-containing snack with three or more meals each week. And so that was about 6 grams of peanut protein per week. So they were instructed to follow this from the time of enrollment, 4 to 11 months of age until age 5. And they then screened for peanut allergy at 5 years of age. And what they found is that about 13.7% of children in the avoidance group, so again, the group that was, you know, following the recommendations at the time to avoid peanuts, actually had a peanut allergy. And so this 13.7% compared to 1.9% of the children of the five-year-olds that were in the peanut consumption group. So that was an 86% relative reduction in the prevalence of peanut allergy. And that, you know, was really a very surprising observation that, you know, actually introducing these infants in early life to peanut paradoxically reduced peanut allergy rather than increasing it. And so that was completely opposite of what most of the recommendations had been. And then they waited another year. So at 6 years of age, they did what they called the Leap On study, where they went back. And so at that time, they said, you know, just everybody eat normally. And they found that peanut allergy was still significantly more prevalent in the participants in the peanut avoidance group than among the peanut consuming group. So that has kind of led to an incredible worldwide change in our thinking about the potential introduction of allergens early in life to prevent food allergies, and has been reflected in recommendations put out by the NIH, by all of the various pediatric and allergy and immunology professional societies. So there's also studies going on at this time that are examining other foods. And so, you know, what they've found, there was a nice meta-analysis that was published in JAMA in 2016 that they found that early egg introduction at 4 to 6 months was also associated with reduced egg allergy, but they didn't find that effect for milk allergy. Strength of the LEAP study, again, that it was a randomized control trial, so the highest level of evidence, and, you know, it's been replicated, and we're now seeing similar effects with egg, but not with milk, and there are other ongoing trials with other foods at this time as well. And I think that we're seeing a change in this and how we consider preventing food allergies. So one point I want to make, though, is that prevention and treatment are quite different. Once that child is actually diagnosed with a food allergy, we still recommend avoidance of that food. But this concept is maybe early on, you can induce more of a tolerance to that food by exposing them, you know, earlier in life via oral routes to these potential allergens.
How do the National Academy's recommendations impact practicing physicians, especially pediatricians and other allergy specialists?
When the committee sat down and we really thought broadly, so the committee was quite diverse in its makeup, but did include several allergists, pediatric allergy specialists. And so when we thought about food allergies, we put it into what we consider an ecological framework. So this ecological framework puts sort of the individual or that child within the family, so within their biophysical environment, which is the family. If they were in child care, school, later on in work, you know, after school programs, and then also the health providers. So these are all groups of individuals who closely are interacting with that child, but then, you know, that child is also within our culture, and so we have cultural and societal practices, we have government policy and regulations, and we have industry practices. So we had people on the committee who work closely with the food industry in terms of not only screening for allergens in foods, but recommendations on food labeling. We currently have a lot of what we call precautionary labeling, where food companies are putting kind of unregulated comments on food labels which say, you know, maybe produced in a factory where, you know, that contains peanuts, tree nuts, and milk. And the problem with that is it doesn't really tell that consumer whether that food actually has it in it, or, you know, maybe there was some accidental contamination because the week before they did a candy bar that had peanuts in it, but, you know, there weren't peanuts present. You know, all the National Academy of Sciences can do is to make recommendations. And the report is available online as a PDF that you can download, and I would recommend that people look to that, and you will see recommendations that are actually made to all of these spheres. Particular for pediatricians, I can refer them to a recent paper that I'm a co-author on that was published in Pediatrics in August of 2017, which is called Critical Issues in Food Allergy, a National Academy's Consensus Report, and this gives, you know, specific recommendations for pediatricians. So I think as a, you know, a pediatrician, understanding that food allergies are serious medical conditions, that working with pediatric allergists as specialists is a good thing to do, particularly in terms of having the diagnosis be conducted, because we don't want to misdiagnose a child with a food allergy. In either way, if we don't diagnose it, they could be at risk for, you know, life-threatening anaphylactic reactions. If we do diagnose a food allergy that isn't true, then we may be causing that child and their family and their environment to be restricting certain foods that don't need to be restricted. So if they, you know, think they have allergy to cow's milk, maybe they're removing all of the dairy products from their diet, and in that case, you know, they may not be getting good quality protein and calcium and other essential nutrients. Accurate diagnosis is critically important to managing that child. You know, if you do have a child who's been diagnosed with a food allergy, you can work with dietitians. You know, there are certain dietitians, and we've made recommendations that we need more dietitians that are trained in this space that can help work with the families in terms of making sure that they know the right kinds of ways, you know, how to read food labels, how to avoid allergens, not only in the home environment, but as they go out in the world. And, you know, this is something that we've seen a lot. It used to be that people would eat primarily in the home, and then they would eat, you know, occasionally at restaurants. But now we see people eating out more. We see children in daycare, and they may be having up to 5, you know, feeding events a day between meals and snacks. Kids go to after-school activities or summer camps where food is present. So, you know, we need to have kind of education broadly and make sure that when you go to that gas station and the person behind the, you know, is making sandwiches, that they know about cross-contamination, for example, that, you know, you can contaminate one sandwich from the other if you're not careful. So we do have in the report really recommendations at all of these levels. I think, you know, for the pediatrician, again, recommending this pediatrics paper, but really understanding that food allergies can be serious medical events, and many times anaphylaxis is the first response that that child has. And so if you have a child in a school environment, you know, we need to make sure that people within that school environment, whether it's the teacher, the principal, the woman or man working in the cafeteria, knows how to recognize if this child is having an allergic reaction, and also the recommendation to have injectable epinephrine available in places where, in schools, on airplanes. I mean, this is something we talked about a lot, because on planes, you oftentimes will have epinephrine, but it's not at an appropriate dose for a child for a food allergy. It's more for cardiovascular events. I think the pediatrician will be, and the physician is the point of contact for most parents. Most children are diagnosed with food allergies. We don't see food allergies except for seafood and shellfish that sometimes are diagnosed in older individuals. Using this report, reading recommendations, and you know, understanding how to correctly test and diagnose food allergies, and then referring the patient and the family to the support that they need. And there's also some wonderful online resources available for families with food allergic children.
And as a final thought, what advice would you like to leave our listeners with?
Yes, I think just understanding these are serious medical events and should be taken seriously, and one of the things that was unique about the National Academy's workshops is that we actually brought in people with food allergies and their parents and heard about their life events. And oftentimes we hear people have indicated to them that, oh, it's really not that serious, and why can't you just have a little bite of, you know, this cake or whatever. And so I think this is part of that. You know, we need to raise the awareness overall that the fact that food allergies are a medical disease. Many kids are able to outgrow some of the food allergies. Particularly milk seems to be one, potentially soy, where even diagnosed in infancy, they may be able to outgrow those, so we should screen children. Some that don't seem to be able to be outgrown would be fish, and shellfish tend to persist longer in life. So, you know, raising the awareness, taking it seriously, you know, both diagnosis and management have substantial, you know, economic, psychosocial, and physiological burdens. So some statistics, so in 2013, the economic cost of food allergies in the U.S. was estimated to be $24.8 billion annually. And the FDA reports that food allergies are responsible for as many as 30,000 hospitalizations, as well as, you know, other medical visits and deaths. So we're still learning a lot about food allergies. I think that this report is a good starting point in terms of, you know, looking at it from an ecological model. So we've really tried to consider the problem quite holistically and pulling together the relevant data as we have it now. And then so in the report, there's specific recommendations at many different levels, but there's also recommendations for future research and education, both in medical schools, but also to the public. Again, I would urge your podcast listeners to Google Food Allergy National Academy's report. It was just published at the end of last year. And to ask questions, you know, there's good resources, training that's available for people who want to learn more about food allergies.
Yeah, great. Thank you so much. So thank you again for speaking with us today, Dr. Donovan.
Sure, it's been my pleasure.